Are you a fan of young adult novels?
Have you ever wondered the stories behind the people who wrote your favorite young adult novels?
Then join author Eric J. Brown
and Alyssa Lube of Netflix's The Circle
every other Tuesday on YAOK.
Available on all podcasting apps.
Woo!
Meanwhile, in New Jersey...
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie, let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and, ugh, the practical effects. and also the male gaze?
My gaze at the males?
Hi-yo! From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. This week, we are discussing the 1976 Tobe Hooper film, Eaten Alive.
Hey, Matt, why?
So this is one that I went back and forth on if I was ever going to pick it, because I really wanted to see it when I was a kid, and I hated it. And then a couple years went by, and I was like, I don't know, I really like Tobe Hooper. I rewatched The Funhouse, and I enjoyed that. So maybe I'll like it more. So I watched again, and I hated it. But then a couple more years went by, and I saw a DVD of it for cheap. And I'm like, seriously, this movie seems like it was made for me. It's a killer alligator movie directed by Tobe Hooper. So I purchased it, and I watched it, and I hated it. But it was still constantly showing up on this list of like, maybe I'll like this. And it was last summer I watched it, and then all of a sudden, like, everything clicked. And it was this moment where I was like, oh, we can discuss this movie now. Like, I finally, whatever it was that was blocking, whatever the blockage was in my brain has been freed.
Do you know, have you pondered what it could be?
So I think what it is this movie is like Tobe Hooper was rewatching his work in Texas Chainsaw and was like, but what if the whole movie was just the last 5 minutes of that movie and just made like this movie is fucking insane. Like every second of it is just pure insanity. The soundtrack is the most insane shit I've ever heard. It's like mathcore. Like it's just like
no wonder Matt loves it.
It's like random synthesizers just like playing nonsensical rhythm with like no hook or anything. Like it's
Maps and Atlases loves this movie.
But when I thought about it, like that was kind of where it started to click. Was like the music to this movie is as chaotic and insane as every single second of it. And then I started to think about how Tobe Hooper made Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 because he felt like people didn't get the humor that was in the original Texas Chainsaw. And I'm like, all of this is supposed to be entertainingly absurd. Like, you're not supposed to buy into any second of it. And for some reason, that was the moment where I was just like, I really enjoy how just batshit crazy every second of this movie was. I think that the choice of like fucked up weird coloring, like crazy, like this movie is crazy in every step. The camera work is insane. The color palettes are absolutely insane. They put like 5 minutes into building this gator. Like the gator looks
the gator
cheap
is,
as
the
shit.
Gator is the least of in this fucking movie.
Yeah, and that's fine. He's literally just a garbage collector, you know?
Yeah, like, Yeah. And I think that that's the other thing that works is, like, they made a movie where it's like, hey, we're only going to kill the characters that you could give a fuck less about for the most part. So you're just like, all right.
Yeah, I was
like,
so happy when the dad got eaten. That dude was just...
William Finley. He fucking played it too, man. Roy, that
I like
character
the big
was
names
insane.
In this. I really do. But here's the thing. I am going to start this episode off with compliments for it.
Okay.
And then I'm going to let Matt defend
it's
himself
gonna be an,
against
Is it
going to
be an open-faced compliment sandwich where you just start the compliment and then
yeah, just
the
no
rest
top
is just...
bread.
Yeah. There will be no sandwich. It is an open face. Just like if I got half of it eaten off by a killer croc. So... The whole point of this movie was that they filmed the entire thing on a soundstage with a pool. And I love that for this because it really led to this dreamlike or like nightmarish. You know, it's very... guys, can I say that this is the Suspiria of killer animal movies? Because it's kind of what I feel like.
Yeah, it's about visuals, minimal on plot.
Like, yeah, and everybody acts insane.
And it all could be on a stage. It literally
but
all
it's,
could be
but it's all,
a stage play.
But the flip side is also, like you said, William Finley, like, killed it in Phantom of the Paradise and in all these other movies. Like, he's fantastic. You've got the original Morticia Adams up in this bitch. Like
wait,
it's a
who is she in this?
The woman that ran the brothel.
The brothel house
Miss
mom,
Hattie?
Who looked like who looked like TCM4 Leatherface.
Yeah,
fuck.
That was Carolyn Jones, Morticia Adams from the 60s show.
She was wearing
show.
Like that what would you even call those hats? Like a dealer hat, you know, at a casino
whatever,
dealer hat.
Yeah, Vegas fucking high roller.
Yeah.
So I did not catch
that at all.
I feel like Toby was like, y'all, I know you can act. You guys are playing to the cheap seats in this one, though. Like, you've got to ham this shit up.
Yeah.
You're not, dude, you're not wrong. I don't disagree with that. Like, I mean, I don't know a lot of Toby Hooper's background, but, like, he feels very theatrical. Like, it feels like stage play. Like, he knows. He knows who can really, like,
he likes to keep it limited, dude. If he can do it to, like, 3 or 4 locations with, like, a cast of, like, 8 people... That's
golden.
Like his bread and butter. Like he's at his happiest. But sorry, Scott, continue the compliment part of this compliment open-faced turkey sandwich.
So I really liked the fact that it's so odd outside where everything's red and there's like a smoke machine going just basically they burnt through about probably 5 smoke machines to do this shoot, you know? And I loved that. And that's where my enjoyment ends because feel like you're having a bit of amnesia on why this movie sucks because the violence against women is so I mean it's an exploitation movie and that's why I never wanted to watch it. As the mom of the daughter gets the shit slapped out of her in the bathroom, I'm like, this fucking I could really do without this. I'm kind of over this movie. And then I'm writing my note like, this is like violence against women. I don't appreciate it. And then I'm thinking, well, other people dudes are getting killed too. And then I'm like, yeah, but they're getting killed with scythes and guns. They're not getting slapped around, you know? And Robert Englund's character is such a fucking sleaze that I just had a really hard time with the characters in it. I understand that the point was to make them unlikable so that they get eaten, but still not an exploitation guy. I feel like this would definitely be more of a Kyle pick because he can roll with that more. Not saying that you like those things, Kyle, but you get more enjoyment out of that 70s and 80s exploitation stuff, like late 70s, early 80s. But for me, I was like, why are the women that are taking their clothes off and the ones who aren't? You know, like, it's just weird exploitation choices.
I almost feel like, again, to a certain extent, because I don't really think of Toby Hooper as an exploitation director, really.
No.
You know what
either.
I mean? Like, so I almost, again, I feel like this was almost his weird version of, like, doing a parody of an exploitation film. Like, I almost feel like he was like, I hate these movies. Let me just make the most egregious, over-the-top version of it. Because one of the other things that I'll give a compliment to this movie about is something that I think Toby Hooper has had a gift with, at least in his early films, is that I'm trying to think. I don't think that there is another, like, iconic horror director who is better at making a location a character in its story.
Oh, like, hell yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we talk about that with, like, Funhouse. Like, the carnival is as much of a character in that movie as any of the other teens. In fact, it's probably more of a character than any of the people involved in it. Yes. I could say the same for the first TCM as well. Like, that house is a character.
That and it's house probably is definitely a character because it's, like, an attraction now.
Yeah. Like, it's almost, and again, take Leatherface out of the equation. The house is probably the second most iconic thing out of that movie.
Every inch of it. Every
you know what I mean?
Of it.
Yeah. And I think that that's the same deal here is like the characters are second to just the setting that he wanted to create, which like you said, it was like we built this thing on top of a pool. We had this animatronic gator in there. Like we had this crazy lighting. Like even when I hated this movie, which I did for 20 plus years, like there were things that were just burned into my brain because he's such a good visual storyteller. Yeah. Case in point, if you're watching the Patreon video, like Kyle has the icon, what I think is the iconic shot of the movie, like Neville Brand just storming with this sickle at the camera. And it's like
color corrected, by the way.
Yeah. Color corrected. But
I couldn't, like, I don't think I could have watched this movie on a VHS PS or anything lower than what I did, which was still on Tubi, but
it was on Shudder.
I don't know why I didn't watch it on Shudder.
No, I popped in my DVD. Double disc DVD.
What the fuck is on the second disc?
It's like a lot of like making of interviews, stuff like that.
I mean, it's a movie that needs to be seen in the best quality that you can, which is crazy. I mean, so there's a lot of things that I want to jump upon. I don't think Tobe Hooper is an exploitation director. No. However, I think that his roots and his interests lend themselves to exploitative storytelling. Because, I mean, this is case in point. I mean, we're talking between Texas Chainsaw and Funhouse, which are both about exploited communities and people. And Eaten Alive is also such that. And it is. I mean, the violence, like, Scott, I hear you 1,000,000%, and I also feel that, like, as a human, as an empathic human, the stuff with women and the logistics and the logical progression of the female characters in here doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Male characters acting upon female characters as if they are objects makes a ton of sense to me. I'm like, well, of course, like the characters that we're building here, Butch, Neville Brand's character, whose name escapes me, Roy, William Finley's character, all of them are exploiting women beyond. And I think, as I would venture to say, and I'm really getting into Eaten Alive here, I would venture to say, as middle-class white men, particularly a middle-class white man, as Tobe Hooper was in the 70s, 60s, 70s, you don't realize the exploitation that you have towards women until it's too late. You exploit women naturally because that's what society has told you to do in this time. And I think whether Tobe Hooper knew it or not, he built a story around that. And about the fear of that. Like, he certainly fears it. That's why there's the whole backstory about looking for the missing woman. It's because he's afraid of what society has taught him to do. So then he builds characters that are so fucking beyond, so exaggerated. So in an early shot of this movie, there is a monkey, then a mannequin, literally back-to-back things. So we're talking about primitive nature versus a standstill, non-human, but something that looks human. And then we go into the whole fucking movie, which is exploitative shit as shit. It's chaos. Yeah. But, like, I'm realizing, and the Funhouse is more refined. I would say Texas Chainsaw is more fucking out of control. And Eaten Alive is somewhere in the middle here.
It's like, a perfect sandwich of those two. Yeah.
I think that's why it's sort of like on a stage. And I'm going to open this now because clearly I need another beer. It's just called Snappy. Because it's because of the crocodile that is so, again, so minimal to what you wanted, Matt Kelly, and I'm sorry. Yeah.
No. So let me. I was looking at some of the critical reviews of this movie, and what I found really interesting is that, in a weird way, the negative reviews also capture what I think finally clicked for me enjoying this movie after five views. Mm-hmm. So I want to read a few of them. This one was from the World Movie Reviews, said, "This is so much the opposite of a Hollywood film. Hooper could not care less that he has shot such a disturbing film that it makes for an uncomfortable watch. Hooper takes us down a different road than the usual trashy macabre horror film, but that does not make it a special film worth seeking out." You know, I agree that, like, this is like him just being like, like, the fact that Texas Chainsaw Massacre was a success was a total fluke. Fuck this. I definitely am not trying to make something like a Hollywood movie. It says here, another review from TV Guide said, "Although Eaten Alive is not as unusual or terrifying as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Hooper does a fine job building up a Southern Gothic atmosphere and continues his brilliant use of sound to enhance a sense of uneasiness and suspense throughout the entire film." And then the AV
Club.
Did they
use the word mathcore in that?
Yeah. No. That's a Matt Kelly special. And then the AV Club, that was really critical of the film, did say that it lacked the eerie plausibility or stylishness of his first film. But this is also based on a real, well,
yeah.
It's inspired by a guy in the 30s who had a bar with an alligator exhibit underneath it. And they later found out that the owner of the bar had killed several women. And legend was that he was disposing the bodies to the alligator underneath the bar. So there is a bit of an inspiration. What I do also find, I won't say charming, that is never the word for this movie, but when you watch this movie, let me ask you this question, because this was the first time this clicked for me when I was watching it the other night. Do you think that this is something Judd has done before, or was this just one bad night that just spiraled wildly out of control for him? Because I think forever I just thought, oh, this is what he's always been doing. But watching it this time, I'm like, oh no, this is just like one unfortunate circumstance happened. And as he's trying, it's almost like that movie Very Bad Things from the night. Like, it's like one bad situation happened, and in his constant efforts to cover up that one bad thing, he ends up having to kill so many other people and basically loses his fucking mind throughout the course of the night.
No, I have a note specifically to that point, because there's a scene where there's the scene where our captive Marilyn Burns is tied to the bed. We cut to Kyle Richards underneath the house. Then we cut to Robert Englund trying to get laid. And then we cut to Neville Brand.
This is the same night. He had two prostitutes earlier on in the night, right?
Yeah. Bro, you know what the crazy thing is? Is that, like, we talk about insane
Scott, he's
buck
and he likes to fuck, man. I don't know what to tell you.
Think about it. Well, we just talk about character arcs being fucking nonsense. Buck's character arc makes the most sense to me. This skeezy-ass dude will do anything to get laid. And he's going above and beyond in one evening, because that's his only goal. That's it. That's all he wants to do. Anyway, we're going back and forth between all these rooms, and we see Neville Brand's character turn on the record and just blast it as loud as he can. It's so clear to me that it's like he is so overwhelmed with his choices. I don't think that he didn't do something like this in the past, or at least do some bad shit that has, like, have been stepping stones to this evening.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's been this bad before, if he's had this many missteps, and we're clearly catching him on a night where he's had the most missteps.
You know, you're talking about all these characters in all these different rooms, and, like, it's so weird because it is essentially one location.
Fuck, I think I like this movie.
No.
It's essentially one location for most of it, but somehow, like, it is so wide open, and there's all these different rooms going on, but the movie never doesn't feel claustrophobic. You know what I mean? Like, every single room, you feel so trapped in that room.
It's a soundstage, and they only had, X amount of space for the fucking camera.
That's that too. It's true. But again, it's true. Like, I wasn't being facetious when I said that. I really think that Toby was like, can we capture the energy of the last 5-10 minutes of Texas Chainsaw and ride it out for 90 minutes? Because it really has the insanity and the intensity of that dinner sequence pretty much from the second we get to that hotel. And it never, it's relentless. This is not like a movie that I like put on for fun, right? Like, and that's never what I was coming here to talk about.
I don't think anybody puts this movie on for fun.
No.
For funsies.
But I think it was one of those things where it's like, I forced myself to watch this so many times, and maybe it was Stockholm Syndrome, who knows? But like at a certain point, I felt like for the first time, I really truly understood what Toby was trying to do with this movie, because there's not a lot of discourse about this movie at all. Like, as far as like horror historians are concerned, he made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, took a 5-year sabbatical, and then made The Fun House. Like,
right.
Like, this is a very forgotten about movie. As shitty as all the characters are, the shittiness of the characters do lead to some satisfying kills. Like, when that dad falls down and that gator just bursts through the wall, and it's the first time you really get a look at it as it like just pulls him under the water, you're like, fuck, like that mm-hmm. was good. Or, you know, the scene that Kyle has behind him, like when that sickle goes through that dude's fucking neck, I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, it's because it
the
did
sickle
so,
was a nice choice, I gotta say.
The sickle was a really nice choice.
Great choice. I don't know what he's cutting down in the swamp. It didn't seem very
practical. I've never been to
me.
Louisiana, so any Louisiana
the,
listeners.
I've never been to the bayou, but I don't
and
know.
And I'm even gonna address... I'm gonna address the thing that we always put a strike on, which is the scene with the dog.
It's so obvious that Snoopy's getting eaten, dude.
It's obvious that Snoopy's getting eaten, but there's something that I like. There's something truly horrifying about that scene to me, which is the way that it's shot. You know what I mean? Like, you see the dog go towards the fence. You see the little girl walk to the fence. And I think it's the fact that the shot is the little girl watching her dog get... Like, you don't ever see what happens to Snoopy.
Oh, yeah.
But you see the girl's reaction to what's happening. And that's almost... That's one of the few times where that's more horrific to me than seeing what happened to the dog, because you're just watching this girl scream and there's just a splash of water with that red in the fog. Like, it is achieving a lot with showing us nothing, which I also think is pretty impressive. Like, I'm not saying this is a perfect
movie. That kid
movie.
Went through hell, dude. That kid went through
She needed a lot of therapy.
She was already in hell. I mean, she was that parental situation was not super fucking healthy.
Yeah, definitely.
To say the least. And now she's being chased by a man with a fucking sickle underneath. Is that what? Yeah, sickle.
Scythe.
Sickle
is a handheld. Slow one? Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, we're not farmers.
I've never goddamn harvested a thing in my life.
and also, like, you gotta love a movie where it doesn't have a whole lot of resolution. You know what I mean? Like, Judd falls into the water, his gator eats him, and then it just cuts to credits. Like,
that's life, baby. That's life.
That's a circle of, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, that was Eaten Alive. I didn't think I was going to convince either person to actually like the movie, but I just wanted...
I think that Kyle convinced himself. You didn't convince me a shit, but that's fine.
No.
I watched this after a rather in-depth conversation about The Fun House. Fair.
I love The Fun House
so
fucking
much. I came in searching. Yeah. And I don't think it's not there. I think that, Scott, like, you are also completely correct.
Don't give me too much credit here.
Ultimately, on paper, it is, on DVD, it's not a great movie. But I think that I found the connective tissue and have exploited the connective tissue for our own conversation.
There we go. I'm happy with that.
Are you a fan of young adult novels?
Have you ever wondered the stories behind the people who wrote your favorite young adult novels?
Then join author Eric J. Brown
and Alyssa Lube of Netflix's The Circle
every other Tuesday on YAOK.
Available on all podcasting apps.
Woo!
Meanwhile, in New Jersey...
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie... Let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and the practical effects. And also the male gaze?
My gaze at the males.
Hi-yo! From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
Hey, do you have an idea for a podcast but don't know where to start? Or do you have an already existing podcast that you want to take to the next level? Well, check out WeKnowPodcasting.com. From concept development to theme music to editing to logos, WeKnowPodcasting.com is a one-stop shop for all things pod. Don't hesitate to hit us up. We're very nice.
Matt, what would you put as your double feature?
Snow Day. No. No, I mean, we've talked about it a lot, but I really, when this movie was over, I was like, I want to watch the Funhouse. Like, I want to go right from here to see what his next step was, because I don't think we ever really see Toby go this insane again. Like, the Funhouse becomes like a full-blown hour slow burn get to the craziness. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. But, like, this is the last
really
time that
does
I think
move. I'll give it that. Like, the pacing is great.
I think it's because the pacing is let's just start in the third act for 90 straight minutes.
Yes, exactly. Why can't... Yeah. I'm fucking J. Jonah Jameson. Let's start more movies in the third act.
But yeah, I mean, Funhouse... And I guess also it makes sense because Funhouse is another one of those movies that when I watched it as a kid, I didn't get it. I thought it was boring and I hated it. And it wasn't until I revisited it one or two more times that I actually saw, like, oh, this movie's really fucking brilliant. And now I would actually put Funhouse probably in my top 10 horror movies. Like, wow. I really like Funhouse. I mean, I like Texas Chainsaw more, but
yeah, I was
still
about to say, and I'm going very obvious. I'm going to go with, I think it was 2006 or 7, Man-Thing movie based on the... And this dovetails into
put
my
a
what
pin
did I
in
watch.
That for my what
yeah,
did
yeah,
I
yeah,
watch?
Yeah, exactly.
This week.
I am nothing if not predictable. But yeah, I haven't seen Man Thing. On the fence about whether or not to watch half of it, and then have us watch it, or just fucking go in blind and make us all suffer. Because I know it's going to be shit, but like
I'm
it
making
might be
us go in
shit.
Blind on a movie next year for sure. So
okay, maybe we'll put them back to back, so we have two really good weeks or two really bad weeks.
My runner up was a movie called Evils of the Night. That was Neville Brand's last movie. Mm. Has nothing to do with Eaten Alive. My actual double feature would have been Motel Hell.
Oh,
okay. Yep.
Oh man. Oh, that's so good. That's also a great Thanksgiving film. That's a cannibal whoopsie for sure.
Yeah, no doubt about
it. If you remember when we talked about Motel Hell, and again, I'm not saying that I want this particularly, but we said the biggest strike against Motel Hell was it couldn't decide what it was. Mm-hmm. It couldn't decide if it was a satire on that type of movie or if it was trying to be sincerely that movie. Mm-hmm. And like, so we got this weird like half. I think that if Motel Hell went the route of
starting the third fucking act, all right,
well just like if it just went all in on like, we're just gonna be a straight up slasher movie and like we're not gonna lean into the jokes too much, or at least not overtly, I think that movie would be even more beloved than it already is, because that is the one strike, is that it is a very uneven movie. It's
absolutely
a fun movie, but it is uneven as
it's
fun.
It's uneven, for sure.
It's fun even.
Fun even. There we go.
Fun even.
So then, Matt, what do you want to pimp out that you've been watching?
I mean, do we want to just say this together? Because I think we have the same one this week.
Yeah, Werewolf by Night.
Werewolf
one,
by
two,
Night,
three.
Baby.
Mamma Mia.
Werewolf
by Night.
No, Werewolf by Night, like... I was just talking to someone about this. I like that Marvel's doing what they're doing, but even I think even the most diehard Marvel fans are feeling a little bit of exhaustion.
I am so exhausted by the serious shit between Werewolf by Night and She-Hulk.
Oh, it was exactly what I needed.
The two best palate cleansers you could have in October. It was amazing.
Yeah, but I think Werewolf by Night really opens this door, and I think we're going to get the same door with the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special of like, yo, Marvel, you don't, and everything doesn't have to be a 3-hour movie or a 6-to-8-part miniseries. It can just be a 55-minute throwing shit at the wall and having a good
it's
time.
It's literally what they used
film.
To do with those holiday special issues, where it would be, instead of 22 pages, it was 48. And so they would tell a longer story. It was a self-contained story. It had characters that you knew or didn't. And it didn't matter if you didn't know them, because you didn't have to know the continuity. It's just you understand their power sets, you understand their dynamic, and you understand their personalities by their interactions. And I would love to see more Werewolf by Night. I would absolutely love to see more Man-Thing, because that was such a great presentation of what Man-Thing does. Also, his powers were like way more intense in the special than they were in the comics. Like, typically his corrosive touch was like it would melt people. It wouldn't immolate them, but I loved it. It was great.
I mean, I knew that I was, and we'll keep this a little spoiler free, but I mean, when in the first 5 minutes you've got a decomposing corpse rigged up to be like a mannequin, basically just like telling them what they're supposed to be doing, and it's like doing Crypt Keeper like puns the whole time, I'm just like, this is fucking awesome.
Yeah, it really so good. Scratched the itch.
like as soon as that happened, I'm like, this is the best thing Marvel's produced in a while.
It was a 1-2 punch for me.
Do you think history will be kind to this era of Marvel property that's not the blockbuster? Because I feel like you guys have given a lot of love to the things that are not the films.
I can categorically say that if I was to rank all of the things in Phase 4 that I loved, it would be way more miniseries and short films than the feature-length films.
I have not enjoyed any of the films in Phase 4 so far. Now, this month we're getting Wakanda Forever, so I think that that's going to be the saving grace, because it's going to be very... It's going to be the...
The transition almost into Phase 5 as well.
Like, yeah, I mean, I know a couple things, and I have heard a couple rumblings about what they're going to do, especially with the post-credits scene. I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to be wrong. Also, I don't want to spoil it. I'm excited. I did like Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness for what it was, but it doesn't have the rewatchability of the original Doctor Strange. Sure. I haven't rewatched. The only movie in Phase 4 I've rewatched is Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness to see if it had rewatchability. And it doesn't for me, which is crazy because it's Raimi and it's Doctor Strange. It should, but it doesn't.
So I'll say these two points and then we'll bounce over to Kyle's. Mm-hmm. But like, I think when Ashley Victoria Robinson was on this podcast, she said something really telling, which was she was talking about Spider-Man, but I think that this applies to a lot of them, where she's like, they're fun experiences, but they're not real movies because they're so built on the experience that it doesn't function like a movie. It doesn't function as a film that you can watch as an individual piece of a story. It's like you have to watch like 8 other movies to appreciate what's happening in an individual movie, and that's a tough hill to climb. But then also, this is the first episode we're recording since I came back from John and Heidi's wedding. So you know that there were some good conversations.
And now we got a pod mother.
Yeah.
Oh, bless. Mommy. Oh, my God. A complete family. Thank God. I felt so abandoned.
You know that there were some geeky conversations going
on
there.
Of course.
I was having a very intense conversation with the person who was officiating the wedding, who was actually a fucking baller ass dude named John Fogelsang, who is a comedian from the 90s. He was a VH1 VJ, and the most infamous thing on his resume is that when he was like 23 years old, he was on Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher to debate Jerry Falwell and the debate.
Nice.
And his example was Jerry Falwell had never debated an agnostic kid who had 2 Christian parents who raised him to know the Bible like the back of his hand. So like, Jerry Falwell would quote a verse, and he would quote the verses before and after it to show how out of context that verse that was quoted had been taken.
We love a completist.
Yeah, we talked a lot about religion. We talked a lot about Marvel and the intersection of them. But we got into a very heavy conversation about multiverses are just a hard sell in TV shows, movies, anything, because it works on paper. It works on like in a comic book. But it, like in a world, like watching a Marvel movie, knowing that there's 1,000 other multiverses in the world, it makes me sit there and go like, well, why are we so fucking sad that Tony Stark is dead if we can just jump to like any of these 5,000 other multiverses and just bring back Tony Stark? Like it just kind of ruins a sense of urgency. So I'm kind of glad to see the multiverse experiment be kind of hopefully put to bed for a little bit and just turn into like linear storytelling.
They're already on the course to do Kang and Secret Wars, and then after Secret Wars, I think that Kang is going to create the incursions that are going to lead to Secret Wars, and then Secret Wars is basically going to be the end of the multiverse shit, hopefully, because they'll have consolidated their properties, they'll get mutants in the MCU, and then we can have X-Men movies. That's the end game.
but the big thing that I always feel like I need to say after we have one of these Marvel conversations is with all of that out of the way, all of those complaints out of the way, it is still fucking awesome that we have somehow figured out a way to create what made the comic book such an interesting thing to read throughout the 70s, mm-hmm. 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and somehow made that translate into film and television. Which means that sometimes it's not always a home run, but like the fact that you literally just laid out exactly how you're going to get to like three major story arcs that will take a couple years to tell those story arcs mm-hmm. is really fucking cool, because that no one makes movies like that. No one sits there and is like, what's the 20-year plan?
Yeah.
That's so, what we call a positive reframe. That's beautiful.
But yeah, all right, Kyle, what have you been watching?
I just think it's so, before I get into that, I have no concept. So hearing you guys talk about it and speculate, and also know, and hearing the reactions of where we're at in phases and have it exist in the world, very cool. I've been watching Queer for Fear on Shudder.
Oh, I want to watch it. Is it good?
It's really good.
Yes.
It's really good. So I watched the first episode, which was all about, I guess, what people would consider some of the pioneers of particularly queer horror. We're talking Mary Shelley. We're talking Bram Stoker. We're talking Oscar Wilde. Like, and that is, it's a blind spot for me. I've not gone back and visited like the literature classics of mm-hmm. this time period, right? I did not watch episode 2 because I caught up on 3 when my friend Jeanette was here. But then we were talking about body horror, not in Cronenberg's world, but like werewolf transformation or body snatchers, like that mm-hmm. kind of body horror. And they spent like, production-wise, I was like, we spent a lot of time on Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but we spent a lot of time in each era of body snatchers.
Oh, that's cool.
50s, 70s, 90s, like able for, you know, like, so at some point in time, I was like, oh, I get it. Like, but I'm also, not to toot my own horn, I'm a little well-versed in some of that stuff. So I'm like, oh, this is this documentary is not completely for me. It's to inform everyone. So I was like, you know, I was getting a little picky and a little antsy to move on from Body Snatchers. But man, the people that they talk to, the insights that they give, it feels both personal and truly colloquial. Is that right? No, it's not colloquial. colloquial is not the right word. It feels that they're sharing their personal stories, but it feels like their personal stories really resonate much wider than such. You know what I mean? Like those personal, it's gone. It's a great doc. It's a great series, and I'm excited to see what the other episodes dive into. That first episode really got me. Really got me. And the third one, when we talk about werewolves and we talk about transformations and the fear of transforming and the fear of change and the fear of becoming, is it a true self? Is it a manufactured self? Which one's which? Like you talk Jekyll and Hyde too. You know, you talk about the dichotomy of presentational self versus a transformative self. And it's just great. It's really, really interesting. It's a little flashy, but it's Brian Fuller. So what do you expect?
I didn't realize it's Brian Fuller, and that really seals the fucking deal now. I'll watch anything he makes.
Yeah. Well, so, Kyle, something you said reminded me that I do want to give a quick shout-out. I still have 2 more episodes to go with watching it, but I have really been having a good time with The Midnight Club on Netflix. It's everything that Fear Street wanted it to be. Like, it's capturing a good 90s tone. I think I still love the haunting of shows that Flanagan did, but this is so fun. This is just like an R-rated Are You Afraid of the Dark, right?
Yeah.
It's a group of kids who are all terminal cancer cases, and every night they sneak out of their rooms to sit around a fire and tell scary stories and make an oath that when they die, they will do their best to come back as a ghost to warn the others of what the afterlife has in store for them. And then maybe potentially finding out that there could be some nefarious things going on in this hospital that maybe there's a reason why they're not getting better. So it's fun, sixth sense shit right there. Yeah, it's a fun watch. So if you haven't watched it for one reason or another, so I feel like they're really not promoting this as heavily as they promoted a lot of the other stuff.
It doesn't come up on Netflix when I open Netflix.
Yeah, it's
on my
list.
Like I literally added it to my list, and it doesn't show up.
Someone told me they were like, I don't understand it. I literally binge watched all of the Michael Flanagan shows the day that they dropped. Like, there's nothing in their algorithm to be like, oh, he'll probably want to know that this is out.
They're fucking clueless over there.
They really
are. I swear
are.
To God, dude.
Netflix is falling the fuck apart. I love them, but seriously, go watch Shudder. That was, and while you're there, check out Eaten Alive from 1977 as picked by me. We'll be back next week with a Kyle pick that I've never even heard of. So I'm very excited to see how that goes. And stay tuned. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Are you a fan of young adult novels?
Have you ever wondered the stories behind the people who wrote your favorite young adult novels?
Then join author Eric J. Brown
and Alyssa Lube of Netflix's The Circle
every other Tuesday on YAOK.
Available on all podcasting apps.
Woo!
Meanwhile, in New Jersey.
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie, let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and the practical effects. And also the male gaze?
My gaze at the males.
Hi-yo! From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.